Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Mark Clovis, your host for the channel. Today I'm speaking with R. Allen Covey, author of the book Inca Apocalypse, The Spanish Conquest and the Transformation of the Andean World. Allen, welcome to the New Books Network.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for agreeing to be on our show. I was wondering if you could start us off by telling our listeners something about yourself.
Yeah, I trained as an archaeologist, and so I came out of a background in classical archaeology and thought I was going to go into Roman archaeology, but wound my way through Mesoamerica and ended up in the Andes. And so I learned kind of the field methods of an archaeologist and have worked in the Andes for about 25 years. But as I've done the field archaeology studying the Incas, I found myself getting into our archives because there are a lot of documents that talk about Inca times. And the more I worked in those archives, the more I realized I needed to understand the colonial side of the Inca world. And this is a project that's kind of brought those two sides together, the prehistoric archaeology and the colonial documents. And in a lot of ways, it's taken me kind of 25 years to maybe feel confident enough to take those two things on side by side.
What led you to undertake such a project? What was it that drew you to the challenges of it and to producing a work like this?
I think it's a project I've been nervous about because it's such a big story. And it's one that people think they maybe know exactly what happens. They say, you know, there's this big battle in 1532. And Francisco Pizarro and his band of Spaniards comes in and captures the Inca and kind of knocks their empire over, and the world kind of turns around that pivotal event. I think it's something, it was this uncomfortable spot between the archaeology. So archaeology didn't carry forward to 1532. When I started doing fieldwork, we didn't necessarily register colonial pottery on the ground when we were doing archaeological surveys. And then because the Incas didn't have writing, we don't have accounts, indigenous ones from before the Spaniards got there. So there's this bubble around the conquest where there's tons of disruption and tons of uncertainty. And then the pieces that go together are from anthropology and archaeology and history, and they don't always play nicely together. So I was nervous about that. But about 7 years ago, I started working with my colleague Sonia Alcanini on an Oxford handbook of the Incas. And we were taking this kind of big arc approach. We're saying, you know, the Incas survived the conquest and we need to talk about the colonial period. And at that time, our editor, Stefan Dronka at Oxford University Press said, hey, you know, has there been a scholarly treatment of the conquest lately? And we got to talking and I thought that it might be a good time for me to do it. And so I threw myself into the project after that.
One of the things I found so fascinating when I read your book was how you present both the Inca and the Spaniards as being alike in so many ways. You don't begin with the conquest, you rather begin by talking about their sense of selves, their identity, their apocalyptic thinking, and you draw from that so many fascinating similarities and comparisons. What did that process reveal to you, and how does it inform our understanding of what takes place in the 16th century?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a central question of the book is, and the word apocalypse kind of grew in significance as the project moved forward. That at the time I was sort of thinking of it as, you know, here's this rupture of the Andean world, and it had to feel like the end of the world for Andean people. And there's a good literature on kind of how the Incas and other people in the Andes thought of these cycles of creation and destruction, and how people place themselves, human activities like agriculture, into those cycles, or how the human life cycle replicated some of those things. And so I was thinking about that, but then as I was working, I said, I don't want to treat the Incas like an ancient empire that is superstitious, and then the Spaniards as a modern society that is rational and somehow like we are today. And so I started, that raised the question, how did Iberian people, how did people that started calling themselves Spaniards around that time think of the end of their world? And so I didn't expect to be dipping back into Christian mythology about the relics of Santiago or St. James, but it became this really valuable way for me to think about the deep histories of both regions, and then the fact that both of them had this tradition of apocalyptic thinking. Both of them had they were experimenting with history at the time, and both of them were also places where two empires were kind of forging a new outlook on how to govern people that weren't like them.
It's something that I thought was especially interesting because we think of it as, these individuals. You have the Spaniards, you have the Inca, they're there, but they're processing everything, as you make clear, through this their understanding of the world, their understanding of the universe. And I thought that was really telling about how they were saying, how do these Spaniards fit into our apocalyptic tradition? How does what we're doing here in Peru fit in with our sense of self and our sense of creation? And I thought that, it really gets a sense of how each side interpreted the other on an equal basis, in the sense of, that you're getting into those mentalities and that process of comprehension that both sides were undertaking 500 years ago.
Yeah, and I think there are two things that are going on there that we talk about kind of two sides, but they turn out to be these two diverse worlds which have all these different opinions going on. So if you look on the Iberian side, you can have recent Christian converts that are expecting, they're predicting a Messiah, and you can have clergy that are seeing things one way, whereas the political elite are seeing this kind of empire building as a kind of apocalypse or bringing about the final years of the world. And it's true for the Inca side too, that I think that's one of the interesting things about the scholarship on the Incas in the last few decades, is how much archaeology has shown us the diversity of that region, and that there are places where, the Incas weren't determining how local people thought or believed, and where local people might have seen the Incas as apocalyptic to their worlds. And so I think having all these different motivations and factions and individual interpretations, and seeing them shift kind of in real time, where you could see, when the Spaniards survive a big battle, they say, well, that's a miracle. Therefore, God must be with us, which means what we're doing is part of this big plan. If they lose a big battle, then they might say, well, God's punishing us because we haven't been behaving correctly. And so there's a lot of kind of worldview making as these worlds are coming together. And I think one of the big surprises for me was how much the Inca nobility of the capital region of Cusco become enthusiastic Christians and kind of place themselves into that worldview and the kind of empire building where other Andean people were more resistant and had kind of a different outlook on the processes that were going on.
I was wondering if you could perhaps elaborate for us a little bit. What was the Inca Empire? What was it like? And what were some of the key structures that proved so important when we get to the story of the Spanish conquest and the Incan response?
Yeah, so then that's a great story. A great question. The as I said, there's been a ton of archaeology that's been done in the last 50 or so years all across the Andes. And I think what archaeology does when it studies ancient states, honestly, that's to say away from the palaces, away from the temples and royal tombs, usually it finds out that the proclamations that the emperors are making are sometimes full of propaganda and wishful thinking. And so the Incas named their world Tahuantinsuyu, which meant the four parts bound together. That to them, it was this, they were this geographic and ecological totality that they encompassed all the diversity of this part of Western South America. But what archaeology shows us is if you go down to the coastal valleys on in the deserts of Peru and northern Chile, there isn't a lot of Inca there in a lot of valleys. That they had these local kingdoms that were kind of ruling themselves in traditions that are very different from the highland tradition that the Incas came from. If you go across the Andes into the Amazonian slope, you don't necessarily find the Incas dominating people. You often find them building roads down to places where they can draw people into trade, where they can have fortified sites where local people will want to come and engage with them. So now I think that we're finding, the more we study the Incas, the more we're seeing their statecraft as being sort of selectively applied. So the Incas built this huge network of roads across the Andes. They built administrative centers and messenger posts and way stations. And those were places where they tried to draw subjects in to encounters with officials that often were related to the royal family pretty closely. And so what we're starting to see is that there are a lot of gaps in the Andean world And those were gaps that the Spaniards, to their good fortune, stumbled into, that they came into places where the Incas had just cruelly conquered local people, and the local people were looking for allies, or they came into places where there wasn't a strong Inca representation, and they were able to take advantage of many people and a lot of leadership in what we would consider the Inca world that didn't really consider themselves directly benefiting from this imperial project.
And so you have that, clash between the Inca and their neighbors, but you also describe that at that particular point in what for the West was 1531, 1532, there's also something of an Incan civil war taking place because the leadership is up for grabs, and that there's this contest taking place in which as you explained, is so important to the opportunity that the Spaniards are confronted with when they arrive.
Yeah, for sure. The ruler, who's named Huayna Capac, he died in the mid-1520s, out on campaign at the northern frontier of the empire, which is up around the equator near Quito, Ecuador. And that death kind of put all these tensions that had been building in Inca power dynamics as the empire had gotten bigger and bigger, that people were getting farther and farther from the capital. The time that it took to travel, the time that it took for information to travel, all these things were becoming more difficult to hold together. And so his death kind of precipitated this division of male Inca power between his son Atahualpa, who is a warlord who had all these frontier veterans from Ecuador, and his other son, Huascar, who had the sort of ceremonial leadership in the capital far to the south in Cusco, who had the support of a lot of the Inca noble factions that lived there. And so you had these kind of two faces of male Inca power that went to war on each other instead of using their power to sustain and make grander or extend the empire. And there's also a gender dimension to it all, I would say that war bypassed a lot of the female power networks that had helped to sustain this empire. That women were major leaders in maintaining good connections to the royal dead and to supernatural figures and carrying out sacrificial activities. So that's something that the Spaniards came onto a landscape that was already apocalyptic in some ways to the Incas, that they had suffered this epidemic, probably European diseases that were moving in ahead of the Spaniards, and they had seen this bloody civil war, and it was totally uncertain to a lot of people whether the empire was going to reconstitute itself, whether its capital was going to remain in Cusco, who was going to be in charge, and then what was going to happen to everyone else. And so the Spaniards wandered into this incredibly uncertain moment, and they were able to take advantage of a lot of folks kind of retooling their strategies and trying to come up with, you know, here's the new world that we want to build here.
Now, to be clear, the Spaniards, when they arrived, they themselves are not necessarily united behind a single purpose. I was wondering if you could perhaps explain a bit what was going on with the Spanish Empire in the early 16th century, and in particular, the dynamic that you described between conquistador impulse and the goal of colonization. Because as you explain, there is a lot of tension there within the Spanish in terms of the desire of Charles V, to push for colonization, and the desire of Pizarro and others to embrace the older conquistador dynamic.
Yeah, I think Spain kind of stumbles into an empire without necessarily having a model for how to govern people that don't have the kind of city governments that you would have found in the Iberian Peninsula at that time. And so it starts on the coast of Africa with the Canary Islands, and then it moves into the Caribbean. But I would say an analogy I would use maybe is it would be kind of the hunter versus the shepherd. That the conquistador is out there trying to get the immediate score and take whatever happens and shed blood if necessary and grab that stuff from far from home and take that back with them. The shepherd is there, literally trying to fleece the flock, keeping them alive, raising up generations. So the colonist for the Spanish side is motivated by different kinds of profit. So from plantations. So we know the familiar ones from the Caribbean, like sugar cane, and a lot of other kinds of crops that didn't grow in Spain at that time. And so this is something where Charles V was eager to have conquistadors go out and explore areas and give them to him. That was the medieval model of finding something and presenting it to a sovereign and then having that sovereign figure out how to govern it. But then he wanted his colonists to come in to set up towns and to set up this kind of a revenue system where he would be getting a cut from the mines and he would be getting a cut from the merchandise that's moving back and forth. And the problem there is that a lot of times the waves of Spaniards that went west into the Americas got to a place like Hispaniola, this big island in the Caribbean, and they found that the best opportunities had already been eaten up, that the best lands were taken, native populations had often already either been enslaved or put into these kind of labor arrangements for the people that had come before. And so you had these new groups of Spaniards that head out into more, farther into the unknown, sometimes as slave raiders, sometimes as explorers, but trying to get quick profits rather than kind of the slow exploitative profit of the colonists. And I think that was one of the biggest surprises for me with this book is that Charles V made it really clear that he was sending Francisco Pizarro to be a colonist. He wanted him founding towns. He wanted him to be paid out of revenues that were going to be delivered to royal officials and make their way back to Spain. Pizarro really flipped the script and went back to being a conquistador, which is what he had been in northern South America, in Panama, in Nicaragua before that.
Yeah, that's one of the things I thought was really interesting was how it was not just Pizarro, but so many of the other ones. I was thinking about when later in the book you describe how word is getting back to Panama about the discovery of the Inca and the first words of all the great treasure that you're doing. And you had all these people that were giving up their encomiendas and sailing down because they wanted to cash in quick. It was like they weren't down for this long-term profit stuff. They wanted to get rich quick and you know, make a fortune that way. And as you explained, that wasn't really a sustainable model even early on in the Incan conquest.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of, it's like a flash mob with the wrong kind of social media, you know, like the word gets out that there's this thing happening. But by the time most people show up, it's already over and they're really unwelcome. So when Pizarro, you know, he captures, you know, Atahualpa, this Inca prince, and he's going to hold him for ransom. And he sends some of the treasure to his friends back in Nicaragua because he's thinking, you know, I need more guys to help me hold this area and represent my interests. But by the time they get there, the treasure has been divided up and there are already, you know, too many guys that want a cut of what comes next. And that's a really big dynamic in the early years is the wave after wave of Spaniards that are coming in thinking that there's going to be more disruption and they're going to get rich quick.
Another thing that for me was really revelatory was discovering how long this process, this expedition had been gestating. I was wondering if you could explain a bit about who Pizarro was and the process by which it launches this expedition in the early 1530s, ostensibly to colonize this region and to establish that Spanish presence in that part of South America.
Sure. I think that's one of maybe the biggest misconceptions of the way we've traditionally told the story. And we tend to kind of tell the age of exploration story as kind of a date, a place, and an explorer. And so we say, you know, 1532, Francisco Pizarro, Inca Empire. And the reality is that the story goes back about 8 years prior to that time. And then it goes back to Panama, where, you know, as soon as they get over to the Pacific side, there are Spaniards that are building boats and trying to learn the currents and the winds and trying to explore up and down the coast. And they know that the local people of Panama and Colombia have gold. And so there's an explorer that kind of makes his way a little farther south than the others from Panama. It would be the coast of northern Colombia. And he hears about a ruler named Biru or something like that. And he comes back and he says, you know, there's this rich guy. I mean, in fact, that's a story that native people told Europeans all across the Americas once they knew that they were coming for gold. Is hey, we don't have any gold, but if you march over to where our enemies live, they have lots of gold, and we'd be happy to carry your stuff to the edge of our territory and point the way out to you. And so he came back with this story. And this man named Pascual de Andagoya, and he couldn't make the trip himself, but Pizarro and his partner Diego de Almagro and a third partner got permission from the governor to sail south, and it was a disaster. They didn't know the currents, they didn't know the winds, they weren't provisioned well enough because there weren't enough boats or enough men or enough supplies to really send any sort of fighting force. They were defeated pretty much in every village they landed. They had to kind of sneak in and steal food, and they lost about 3/4 of their men. And it got so bad that when they would send back for supplies, there was one ship where the men that were kind of stranded on the beach waiting for food, they sneaked notes back to the governor in Panama. They're like, please get us out of our contract with this guy. He's horrible. But in this process, Pizarro and his navigator made this kind of desperate venture into the south, and they came out of this kind of tropical landscape and into this world of pyramid-filled cities with coastal roads and special fishing and farming economies and merchants and lots of precious metal and so they knew that this was something different and so Pizarro went back and he knew that he needed to get royal permission to do something really big there. And so he actually sailed back to Spain and went to court and he said, hey, I found this civilized world and the local people are friendly. And Charles V actually wrote to his counselors. And he said, this is such a civilized place that we only need to send 250 Spaniards that they're going to set up colonies. We don't even need to do any fighting. And so Pizarro made a contract in 1529 that said, you're going to sail with X number of Spaniards from Spain. You're going to go by this route. You're going to be there by such and such a time. And when you get there, you're going to found four towns along this stretch of the coast. And you're going to set these people up as municipal officers. You're going to appoint these people as priests. You're going to do these things with the revenues that are coming out of mining and out of agriculture. So it was this kind of fully formed colony, and it all fell apart. He sailed illegally from Spain without the number of people he was supposed to. He didn't take the route he was supposed to. He didn't leave Panama for Peru until after his contract had expired. And then it kind of cascaded forward from there. So the empire that Charles V thought that he was building, it took him a few years of sending letters after Pizarro saying, hey, what's going on in Peru? Hey, you know, you need to give us an accounting of all the places that you founded, because you should have founded something by now. There should be some sort of colony there. And in many ways, it's only this kind of big score of precious metal that kind of makes Pizarro look like he's done what he's supposed to. And in fact, kind of a kind of side fact of that is the first stories of the expedition that come back to Spain, they use titles that are very clear that they're trying to convince people that Pizarro did what he was supposed to. So, you know, saying the conquest of Peru, that Pizarro did for the crown of Spain, there's a lot of kind of really needing after the fact to say, hey, you know, we felt that it would be better to apologize and to ask permission, and now we have all this gold and silver to give you.
So I was wondering if you could perhaps explain the you know, the march that Pizarro undertakes to, because as you describe the geography, it's not an easy thing to get to Cuzco the Inca Empire, and that it's a very debilitating experience. And then, of course, when he arrives in the middle of this, you know, ongoing Incan drama. And how does Atahualpa, you know, view them, and how does he basically, in effect, make himself vulnerable to the Spanish to the point where they're able to capture him?
Yeah, so the Spaniards, it takes them a long time to make their way down, in part because they've got horses with them. And that's one of the big decisive things that makes them more successful than they had been farther north on the coast. So once they could ride on Inca roads and take food out of Inca storehouses and sleep in the buildings and along the Inca highway, their horsemen could move faster than Inca message runners could run, that they kind of had the initiative. They could send very powerful small groups of cavalry and to scout out areas and to keep them informed. So they land with their horses because the horses don't do well on the ocean in these small ships. And they make their way by foot. Native people carry them in rafts. So they eventually make it to the Inca roads. And along the coast, they start learning that there's been this civil war. And in fact, the city of Tumbes that they were supposed to colonize first, they find kind of as a smoking ruin. And then the local people have fled, that they don't want to have anything to do with the Spaniards who have just been spending some time with their mortal enemies. And so the Spaniards come in and they're kind of trying to figure out, you know, what do we do on the coast? And then they learn more and more from the coastal lords about this civil war, and they hear that there's this these two brothers have been fighting. One of them has just defeated the other, and Pizarro says to his men, you know, we should head inland, because if we can get that guy, then the rest of this is going to kind of fall in place. And so the people on the coast, actually, some of them go to fight with the Spaniards. Some of them come as porters. Some of them serve as spies. They give them supplies along the way. So there's a ton of native support, because Atahualpa had just gone through that area to punish people that hadn't supported him in the Civil War. And so you have this kind of shell-shocked, burned-out region, and Pizarro comes in, and he's doing his share of burning people and doing kind of shock and awe. But is that I think the local people figure, if we can send them against Atahualpa, you know, one of these sides is going to end up dead. And so for Atahualpa's part, it really depends on the version of the story that you read. But he seems to have a lot of anxiety. He's this warlord, but he's not really the Inca. He's been trying to do some ceremonial things that will make him seem Inca, but a lot of them backfire. Like he goes and consults his oracle, and I think he's hoping the oracle is going to say, yeah, you're going to be a great Inca. And instead the oracle says, you shouldn't kill so many people. And so he takes an axe and chops up the stone that supposedly is where the oracle speaks from, and he kills the man who speaks for it. And so he has this kind of violent inferiority complex in some ways. And so he's won a war, but it's not clear that he's going to what kind of empire he can kind of get people to recognize him as the ruler of. And so when the Spaniards come in, that they seem like both an opportunity and a potential threat. So there aren't a lot of them. And some of Atahualpa's counselors are, they say, there aren't that many. You can just have them sleep in one giant building at one of your way stations and set the thing on fire and kill them all. But then there's also an opportunity that they're pretty bloodthirsty, good fighters, and he's got a lot of enemies. And so there's a lot of messages that go back and forth between Pizarro and Atahualpa. And one of the curious things to me doing the reading of this was through the different lenses of what each side thought was going on. So Atahualpa sent food and drink to Francisco Pizarro and sent gold cups and things like that. For Pizarro, it's gifts and maybe tributes to the Incas. If you drink out of the Inca's cup and drink the Inca's beer, you're saying that you are their subject. And so there are things that are going on. And then for the Spanish side, the Spaniards are saying, hey, we want Atahualpa to know. We consider that it was okay for him to fight against his brother, even though he was Inca. We love him and we want to be we want to fight for him. And what they're trying to kind of express as subjects of Charles V is saying as his subjects, if you become a vassal of Spain, we'll fight for you. What a lot of that sounded like to Atahualpa was, we're coming to surrender to you. We're going to drink your beer. We're going to go out and fight your fights. And so when the two sides came together in this Inca city of Cajamarca in the northern highlands of Peru, this is November 17th, 1532, Atahualpa was coming in. I think he thought that he was going to receive if not surrender, just the loyalty of kind of these new strange fighters. The Spaniards, for their part, had an ambush set up. They were preparing to grab him from the day, at least that day, as they saw the Incas coming. But they had their armor on, their horses were saddled up inside the Inca buildings. And so the encounter, a lot of people call it the Battle of Cajamarca, but the Incas, they'd never really fought in the plaza of one of those cities before. That they I think firmly believed they were coming to show the magnificent spectacle of the emperor that wanted to be. And the Spaniards grabbed him as soon as he came into the plaza.
So they now have the Inca, and to be clear, we use that word for the empire, but it also refers to the position of the ruler of the people. But so they have the Inca, and they then begin to demand, they begin to extort payments. What are they getting, and how is this fitting in with what's going on within the Incan Empire itself?
Yeah, so I think there are two sides. Do a lot of quick thinking in this moment. On the Spanish side, there's already a precedent for grabbing rulers on the battlefield and holding them for ransom. That was a medieval idea, but even more recently, Cortes had done that with Montezuma in Mexico. Spanish troops had grabbed the King of France on the battlefield. They had grabbed the Pope within recent years to get better treaties, to get payments of ransom. So for their part, they were open to this idea of payment. For Atahualpa's part, knowing that they wanted gold and silver, he wanted to live long enough to try and recover from this. And so I think to say that he was Inca, the Spaniards knew that he wasn't the crowned Inca, and Atahualpa hadn't been crowned in the capital as Inca, but it was convenient once the Spaniards had him to say, we have the most powerful Inca Lord. And so Atahualpa said, hey, I'll give you a bunch of gold and silver if you let me go. And for him, he knew that it would take a long time to send the news out to areas where the treasure would come from, to kind of strip it off of buildings and pull it out of palaces and tombs and carry it up to these northern Peruvian highlands. And he also knew that once the Spaniards had it, they would be so encumbered by just the sheer mass of gold and silver that they couldn't move around the landscape the way that they might like. And so he kind of locked them into place with this kind of promise of a conquistador's treasure. And then he did something really smart, which was he told them to go and plunder all these people that were his enemies. So he sent them basically to do damage to the factions that hadn't supported them. And at the same time, he got them to allow him to kind of reconstitute his court in the palace at Cajamarca, to bring in powerful women, to bring in the kind of gold and silver serving vessels, to receive messengers and to have his advisors there. And so he got to seem to be Inca while trying to figure out what the next step in his story would be. But the Spaniards also were considering how they could get by without him and what they would do. And so in the months that followed, there's a lot of strategy making that results basically with Atahualpa executed in Cajamarca and the Spaniards riding with another Inca toward the Inca capital of Cusco with the intention of settling a Spanish town there.
What you describe in the pages that follow, I thought was really interesting because it's so unlike the, you know, what we might have perceived as the narrative of Pizarro having conquered it. Rather, you have these Spaniards who still number barely in the hundreds who are basically there on Incan sufferance. There's this understanding, you make it clear that yes, they have they have firearms, but their powder and their shot is limited. And there is an awareness that once that happened, that's gone, there's no opportunity to replenish it. That their horses, formidable as they are finite in number. And as you described, the Inca are perfectly capable of ambushing these cavalry and dislodging it before they are. So it really is a very tenuous situation where. It was a fascinating conception of it, of the Spanish is simply one set of players in this very unsettled environment in the area which the Spaniards are only gradually asserting a presence and a control.
Yeah, and I think that's an interesting part of this story is that one of the reasons a lot of these Spaniards survive, a lot of them don't, but one reason a lot of them survive is that Inca women find it, maybe it's a duty, maybe it's an opportunity for their families to make alliances with leading Spaniards. So you have Inca princesses that by the time the Spaniards are marching to Cusco with their Inca allies, they're Inca princesses that are pregnant with some of the first mestizo children that are going to be born in the Andes. And those women convert to Christianity really early. They supply the Spaniards with information. They help to convince their male relatives to fight for the Spaniards. And they get written out of the story. That I think that's one of the things I've tried to do with this book is to restore how important these women were for keeping, you know, a completely united Inca Andean world from coming down on the Spaniards all at once, which would have easily destroyed them. So that's something that, but it is, it's touch and go. When the Spaniards have an Inca alliance, they turn on each other. And the only thing that brings the Spaniards back into alliance is when the Incas are threatening them. And it kind of goes back and forth that there's a lot of fighting. Hundreds and hundreds of Spaniards are dying in wars with indigenous people, and then wars with other Spaniards all the way up into the 1550s, for 20 years after Pizarro gets there.
That was one of the points that really stuck with me, was reading about that last battle that takes place in the early 1550s with Gonzalo Pizarro, Francisco's last surviving brother, and how you have him and this group of conquistadors, and he really has gone off the reservation. He has assumed a lot of the trappings of an indigenous of sort of a transplanted king. And you describe how this battle in which he's defeated, you have literally Incans fighting on behalf of the Spanish king, defeating a group of Spanish conquistadors who are in effect fighting for themselves. It's almost like a reversal of positions from, say, 20 years previously.
I think that it's a really important theme of the Incas and a lot of Andean nobles saying, hey, Spain is going to preserve our noble status. I think that's a really important point, is that there's so many Andean nobles that could carry the title of Don or Doña once they converted to Christianity, which meant that they socially outranked most of the Spaniards that were in the Andes, because those people were non-noble. And so seeing that their privileges, their lands, their access to labor was better protected by supporting the crown, you see the Incas as early allies, and something kind of, if you were to trace this forward to Peruvian independence from Spain in the 1800s, when the last Spanish viceroy is defeated in Lima, he flees to Cusco, which is this ancient Inca city, and the descendants of the Inca emperors welcome him, and they want to have a ceremony where they dress up as their ancestors because they say, we're still good Spanish subjects. I think that's something that another really important theme for this book, too, is how much the native side wasn't just native against European. It's different indigenous self-interests playing out. And something that I haven't mentioned yet in this interview is also how important Afro-Peruvian and African descent populations are in this story. By the time you get to these later rebellions, like say in the early 1550s, you have hundreds of people of color that are fighting in the civil wars because they're fighting for freedom. And a lot, they're fighting for their king, or they're fighting because they've been promised liberty from enslavement. And they're a big part of the story that is left out when you treat it as sort of Europeans against Native Americans.
Mm-hmm. The other thing I was really struck by about this, though, was the how, all these interests are at play, and how every group is making this calculation to defend their interests. And I was thinking about it in terms of going back to what you're talking about with the Incan being good subjects of the Spanish emperor, is that you have a situation where, as you explained, that the Spaniards have effectively overpromised so much stuff. And at some point, they're practically engaging in these risky explorations, these wars, just to kill off all these Spanish who are expecting all these encomiendas and territories that, in effect, they can't give because the Incans are getting so good at protecting their domains. That notion of interest being of all the interests at play, really comes out in your narrative about how it's not a sense of ignorance versus the wisdom of the Spaniards or the cunning of the Spaniards, but there's a lot of cunning and gamesmanship taking place on all sides in this.
Yeah, and I think that's something when you pull this story apart from a single battle where you have this kind of mythical idea that Pizarro didn't know where he was. He didn't know what he was facing. He was just brave and fought and lucky, and the Incas had no idea what they were facing. When you stretch it out to fit kind of two or three decades, the Incas learned very quickly and they adapted, and the Spaniards learned quickly and their motivations changed. And even in that theme of apocalypse, that changed. So that by the 1550s, you have the poor foot soldiers thinking that they're building some sort of utopian world where they should have access to free land and labor. And then you have, at the same time, you have Incas that are fashioning sacred objects that they can carry in the Catholic Corpus Christi procession, because that's where they've thrown their lot in. And so I think that was maybe one of the really important things to take away for me with this project, is that, the Incas learned a lot and put that learning into new strategies because this went on long enough for them to consider what their next move was going to be.
And yet, as you explain, once a lot of the fighting is out of the way, by the time you get to the mid-1550s, in some respects, that's when the process of assimilation truly begins. And as you explain later in the book, a lot of those strategies that the Inca adopt don't necessarily work out very well for them, especially as during the viceroyalty of Toledo, where there seems to be sort of a reassessment that doesn't necessarily benefit the Incans as much as they might have hoped.
Yeah, and I would say, I mean, you can kind of see that it's after the royalist armies defeat the last rebellious Spaniards in the 1550s that you see this kind of move to consolidate Spanish rule. And so you have viceroys that are saying, hey, you know, we need to make sure that native elites don't have as much wiggle room, that they're not getting rich, that they're not controlling local labor, that they're not hiding tributary workers from us, all these things that they're accusing the indigenous elite of doing. But they're also really suspicious of the kind of labor grant holders among the Spaniards, and they're suspicious of the priests. And so, at the end of the 1560s, Philip II of Spain sends this viceroy, Francisco de Toledo, and basically he's saying, you know, you gotta ensure that the revenues from the mines are sending me the silver I need, and you've got to get my officials looking at my interests so that all of my subjects are serving me. It's not just about kind of crushing the Incas, but some of that comes with, because of the rhetoric of an empire that's built for conversion to Christianity. That's the time when they're sending the Inquisition and the Jesuits are coming in. They're saying, well, we have to be sure that people are good Christians. We have to be sure that it's not just the elite, but also the ordinary people in the countryside. And that viceroy comes in, and eventually he just adopts this very anti-Inca program where he says, you know, the Incas are illegitimate. I want to bring an end to them. He actually arrests a bunch of the Incas in Cusco after constructing this really elaborate legal case against their sovereignty. So he's saying, you know, you can treat them as Indians. They don't have to be treated as a people that are set apart or as descendants of actual lords. They're just your tributaries. And so so he did a lot to destructure. And I mean, he actually intended to resettle the nobility of Cusco, some of them in Mexico, which didn't actually come about. But for sure, over time, the Incas saw that the sovereignty that one Inca held, a lot more Inca men could have the status of nobility, but it didn't carry as much kind of power and wealth and over time. That the privileges became much more limited to the city of Cusco, limited to pretty modest estates. And so it is something that the bargain that they made, you know, in the 1540s and 1550s, a lifetime later, their sons and grandsons, yeah, just didn't necessarily have the same kind of status, even though they still considered themselves the descendants of emperors.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
Yeah, this I think one of the big takeaways for this book for me was how much European genres and writing changed in the time that people were writing about the Incas in this first century after Pizarro arrived, and you know where you can have the Incas, you know, written about in a play. Or you can have them in a heroic poem, or you could have them in a world history, or in a book that's about the martyrdom of saintly people. And so it was something that kind of blended together with some of the dissatisfaction I've seen in modern scholarship about how the Incas don't fit into the models that we have for states and empires. And so I'm working on a book that's called The Inca Exception, and it kind of takes this... this plays are saying the Incas are kind of put over into anthropology, and a lot of the ideas that we have about how states work, what government looks like, that it's bureaucratic and territorial and doesn't involve kind of kinship. A lot of that stuff is coming from the European side. And so this book is kind of tracing the way that Europeans, as they developed their own sense of being modern and being enlightened and being civilized, the way they told and retold the story of who the Incas were, that the Incas were a kind of tragic pagan civilization. They were victims of the Spaniards. They were enlightened despots. Eventually, you know, when we see the kind of scientific racism that develops in the 19th century, they're treated as the best of an inferior race. And eventually they're part of anthropology, which is part of the reason that they don't fit into some of these modern theories in political science or sociology. And so it's a kind of big arc that uses these imagined or reimaginings of the Incas over time that's kind of intended to help us understand how we got to where we've been talking about them today, like and maybe some productive ways for rethinking how we talk about ancient states and empires.
Well, it sounds like a fascinating project and a pretty big one, too.
Yeah, we'll see if it comes off.
Well, Alan, thank you for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Yeah, thank you for the invitation. This was a lot of fun.